You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that sometimes lift and sometimes just separate them from the average genre fare. Are you joining us for the first time? Well, we would like you to know that this podcast is unscripted. Is that what I said?
I said un. I was emphasizing your un.
David and I come into this blind every week. We do not know what each other is going to say. We watch the films and then we get together and discuss them. So when we stammer, it is part of the natural process. Bear with us. And for those of you returning, I believe you already know this. David and I have a lot of movies in our head. We concentrate basically on the genres of sci-fi and horror, but picture, if you will, as Rod Serling would say, all the movies in our head, because we don't normally limit ourselves to these two genres, only for the podcast. So, again, bear with us when we're somewhat overwhelmed. Speaking of David Horton, I'm here with him today. He is my friend and co-host. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, and a good intro. I mean, do remind everybody, you know, make sure you subscribe, give us a rating, a review, that sort of thing. If you like what you're hearing today, we'd love to hear from you, sort of thing. Normally, we start with what you've been doing in your genre week. Well, I have an accomplishment. I actually did something interesting with my genre week.
Holy shit, Batman.
I did, and it was science fiction. So there's that. I finally got to watch... now I've just totally lost the frickin' title because it's not in front of my notes in front of me. Don't Worry, Darling. Have you seen that yet?
I have not. I hear negative stuff about it.
Oh, well, yeah, you heard right. Pretty much.
That's unfortunate.
It is. It is because I really liked her directorial debut. This is
Olivia
Wilde. Directed. I really liked her previous film.
Booksmart.
Yeah. They're two high school girls that say that they've always been 4.0 students and now it's time to party. It's that kind of thing. It's her kind of Judd Apatow sort of teen comedy, I guess.
But yeah, it's like a female perspective of the same genre.
And very intelligent, very funny, great performances, everything else. This has like three or four really great performances, but it is such a mishmash of story. The style is awesome. Her photography
is awesome.
Well, he's Harry Styles. He does a great job.
He does? Okay.
He does. He does a really good job. He's kind of one note all the way through it, but fine and adequate. Florence Pugh, phenomenal. Chris Pine, great as a villain. Really good. Olivia Wilde is actually in it as one of the leading supporting characters. Mm-hmm. And she's really strong in it too. But it's got Gemma Chan, who I love. And you remember her from Eternals. She's just phenomenal and everything else. It's got several other great supporting characters. But basically, this is just I don't want to give it away if you're going to watch it, but it's just...
I don't know when, but...
mishmash of everything you've seen before.
Well, it looks a lot like Stepford Wives. We've already talked about that.
Yeah, and it is a lot. It's Stepford Wives meets Nope. I mean, not Nope, meets... what was his other one?
His
first one. No. Yeah, Get Out. Is in there as well. And a couple of, you'll see them as soon. I mean, they telegraph from a mile away. And the ending is just absolutely not worth it. I was going, maybe she'll redeem herself at the end. There'll be some really cool twist or something like that. No, it's exactly what we predicted about, 10 minutes ago. sort of thing. So unfortunately, it wasn't a great genre week for me, and I can't really recommend Don't Worry Darling to anyone other than if you're a Florence Pugh fan, because she is always awesome.
I would probably watch it for her.
Yeah, the voice and characteristics alone, she just drives the entire movie. Yeah. But other than that, not a winner. So there's that. What about you? You did anything horrific this week?
Well, yes, I did.
Did you?
Yeah, and speaking of winners, you know, you win some, you lose some, and it's kind of the same with this one.
Oh.
I was watching on Shudder two movies.
One. At the same time?
No. a movie and its sequel, Satan's Slaves,
ooh,
from 2017.
Okay.
And Satan's Slaves Communion from 2022. Both fairly recent movies that have a distinct qualification. They are both Indonesian films.
Really?
Yes, I had never seen an Indonesian film before, and when I looked to see if there's any popular ones, I could not find any that I recognized. But it was the highest grossing Indonesian film of 2017. These movies are very highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes. As a matter of fact, the sequel gets 100%. The original gets 91%. But it is apparently, the first one is a remake of an 82 cult classic called Satan's Slave, which was also an Indonesian film.
same people involved?
No. But the guy that wrote and directed this, or the guy that directed this based on that first film, his name is Joko. It starts with a J, Anwar. And he describes being totally terrified by the original when he snuck into a theater to watch it as a kid. And that's why he decided to remake it. What's funny is, or what I found interesting, both films are unique and feature the exact same family and cast. The first one, of course, is based on the original. I don't know which one I like better. I like them both equally for their visuals and for their being scary. As far as making a hell of a lot of sense, they don't. And I don't know if it's a cultural thing or if it's just sloppy filmmaking. I don't know. It stars, of course, many of Asian persuasion, so I don't really know anybody. But the synopsis of the first one is, after dying from a strange illness that she suffered for years, a mother returns home to pick up her children. The movie is set in 1981. So not only do you feel discombobulated watching a movie from Indonesia, you're also watching a movie out of time.
Right.
Because it looks like it was made when the original was made, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's very, very strange. And then, of course, I won't go into the synopsis of the second one, but obviously the family survives, but there's more afoot. And as I mentioned, the first one scored 91. The second one scored 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I would highly recommend watching them as far as the creep factor and the style factor. But if you're looking for a lot of logic, don't open that book.
Hmm. Okay.
That makes sense.
Sad but true. Sad but true. I mean, culture has a lot to do with it. I mean, when we talk about the film today, culture is a huge part of the story itself, and what part of some of the reasons that they chose to do what they did. So it's interesting because you have an affinity more so than I for foreign films. And I think you appreciate more the nuances of foreign films, more than I. They tend to frustrate me more just because I usually end up doing subtitles, which means I'm reading and trying to watch at the same time, which I don't enjoy at all. Even though these young kids today, it's their favorite thing. Turn the subtitles on.
Their phones.
Yep. Turn the subtitles on. I talked to somebody just last week and they had watched a movie that we recommended and they said, I didn't like it. And I said, well, first of all, where did you watch it? Did you watch it on your phone? Because you can't watch movies on your phone. It's just don't do it and don't expect them to be good. And he said, yeah, I watched on my phone. I said, oh, okay. And he goes, but I also couldn't hear it because I was with a bunch of other people. So I was just, you know, I had captions on and watched it. I went, you had the sound off and you watched the movie and you say you don't like it? Of course you don't. I mean, I don't understand. Why would you even force yourself to have that experience?
What was the movie?
Oh, I forgot what it was. It was something that we recommended, though. It was something we liked.
I was curious.
But he read the movie, essentially, you know, on his in his lap on his phone with other people around and everything else. And I'm like,
it was the green slime, wasn't it?
Then you're not. No, it was. It was the green slime. He didn't appreciate it the same way we do. Well, we are going to space. We are going to space today. We are going to well, before we jump into it, let me get notes up so I can ask you my first two questions, because I had these two questions.
Oh, my Lord.
Here
we go.
I wanted to ask you. No, it's not Inquisition. It's just I just wanted to ask you something.
What was that Monty Python skit? It's the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition. Yeah. We are going to jump back to 2019.
Very current.
For a movie called The Wandering Earth. It is from China. There's a caveat to this, at least from me, and I'm assuming from Tim as well. My caveat is I will not be able to pronounce anyone's name. So, apologize, but it will not be good pronunciation of names when I attempt it. And more than likely, as I'm talking through the story, I will refer to these characters as what the characters are, rather than their names.
It's easy to pronounce their first names. It's just not easy to pronounce their last name.
Yeah, like you get Liu Qixing or Qinzin.
Yeah, I mean, there's two Lus, a father and a son. They're both named Liu. But then there's a grandfather named Wang and a friend named Han.
And another
friend named Han, or another person named Han. And then there's Tim, who was in the prison cell with the guy. But anyway.
Right. Well, before we run into it or whatever, had you ever seen this movie before?
I had never even heard of this movie. Okay. I was kind of surprised by it.
And surprised in what way? I'm very curious to get your initial thoughts before I even go into synopsis or anything.
Oh, wow. I don't know where to go. I really, really want to like this movie because it is what – I mean, if I had to describe it, it is science fiction escapism overload. And the only other way I can encapsulate that is it reminds me of an amusement park ride. It's one of those things where it's just 90 miles an hour for the whole entire thing. And then it's over and you're like, what did I just do? That's my initial reaction.
Good. Okay. So, I'm glad. I was curious. I had seen this before in 20. I saw it in 2020 and was blown away by it just because, A, I had never seen this has a, like we said, cultural kind of significance. This was the first major sci-fi extravaganza from China.
Right.
China is known for a lot of historic drama, a lot of great timely pieces, and some great dramas. But they've never really delved into science fiction before. And they decided to really delve with this one and jump all the way into it with both feet, both hands, a spacesuit on, and a great big truck sort of thing. Because it is, as you said, it is a ride from the very beginning. It is over the top. David will, I'm sure as we get into it, I will discuss some of these scientific inaccuracies.
Oh, my God.
Kind of have to say, okay, we're just going to accept that, I guess. And we're just going to go with that. So those are some caveats to it. But it was... like I said, it came out in 2019. It was a limited release in China at first, then it blew up, then it went international, then it got bought out by Netflix, or Netflix at least started distributing it in the United States. It's based on a short story by Liu Qixin, C-I-X-I-N, who is the source novel. It's directed by Grant Guo, G-U-O. Basically produced by his production company and several Chinese, government officials, that kind of stuff, everything else. This movie, one of the big producers of the distribution of it was Alibaba Pictures. And Alibaba is the Amazon of China, essentially. Alibaba is the...
It sounds like it would be Indian.
Right.
Or like yep. Middle Eastern. That's funny.
Yeah, that's their company. And they essentially are the Amazon of China. And most of Indonesia, most of that whole entire continent. Going into India. So it may have been originally.
Asia in general, because it does encompass a lot of that. Yeah.
So it may have been originally an Indian company that, you know, started, mm-hmm. perhaps, or something like that. Anyway.
And there are a lot of films that come out of India, so it's very possible. I just don't know.
And I know it from ordering a lot of technological stuff and gear and everything else that comes from China. Alibaba has it cheaper. Here, go buy that there. Yeah, so it's Amazon. Yeah, that sort of thing. This movie ended up grossing $701 million.
It was a huge hit.
It is the highest grossing film in China of all time. And I will step out on a limb and say I enjoyed this movie, would watch this movie, appreciate this movie more than I would ever watch Avatar again. I think it is better than Avatar visually. I think it's because it's one thing to say, oh, can you CGI a giant flying pterodactyl? It's another thing to say, can you CGI somebody realistically in a spacesuit with this kind of environment, you know, walking through Earth or trapped, underneath a thing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have some theories behind your reasoning there, and I think it's mainly because Avatar is more fantasy based, whereas this is more science fiction based.
Correct. Oh, totally.
Right.
Totally agree with that. Yeah. But also, you know, both of them have story issues and story elements, but this one is so far superior story wise to Avatar as far as the plot holes and the problems and the issues and everything else. And I just, you know, overall, I think the graphics, the visuals of this movie are better, in my opinion. That's just me, though.
My opinion, as far as that is concerned, is that I will watch both movies. I will watch Avatar and I will watch this movie, and I will probably never watch them again because they're like cartoons to me. It's almost like they're not real.
Well, yeah.
They're so heavily CGI'd that I just lose interest very much the way we were discussing sitcoms before this.
They don't
interest me. Yeah.
Interesting, because if the CGI is so effective that I don't notice it, I like it. You know, that's another issue that I have with Avatar. It's giant blue people. You know, this is trying to recreate realistic people.
Right.
You know, sort of thing. And another reason why I give it to them. We'll get to that when we get to effects. But basically, sure. Just a short synopsis of the story. If you haven't watched this movie, don't, while you're listening to us, go watch it right now. Spend some time, enjoy it, come back.
And it's on Netflix, so you can watch it. You can watch it dubbed or subtitled.
It is actually on YouTube as well. You can find it on YouTube as well, the dub version, which is what I watch. I'm curious, which one did you watch, subtitle or dub?
Both.
Okay.
I watched it dubbed with subtitles.
Okay.
I always do that. And also, subtitles. There's lots of explosions going on, so I may not hear what they're saying.
Yeah. I see, that's another reason why I can't do subtitles, because it says explosion. Okay. I don't need it to say that. Or it says birds chirping. Or the worst one, any form of descriptive music. It says dramatic music. You know, horror chord. I go, I don't need you to do that for me. I'm sorry. But anyway.
Well, but you're not deaf.
Right, which is why people who aren't deaf shouldn't watch captions. Just saying. This is me.
I left the sound on, unlike your friend. So.
Yes, at least you did that. That's good. Yeah. But basically, the story is, and this is scientifically accurate to an extent, the sun will eventually turn into a red dwarf. Our sun will eventually die. What we do when that time comes is kind of up to us. What this movie theorizes is that in the future, find out that the sun is going to die. It unites the governments of Earth. So they become the United Earth Government. And they all decide, hey, rather than put everybody in spaceships and colonize another place, a la the Ark that, you know, is coming to get us or whatever, or any of these other survival type shows, we will instead move the Earth. We'll just move the Earth. We've got the science to do it. We're going to move the Earth to the closest sun that we can get to, which is Alpha Centauri, which is 4.5 light years away. So it's about a 2,000-year journey to get there. In order to do that, we have to be able to navigate and do the things we do and everything else. So we have an International Space Station, which is essentially leading the way. We have turned it into essentially a sleeper ship space vessel, and it's going ahead of us to navigate. And things go pretty good for a few years until we end up getting near Jupiter, which is totally scientifically accurate. Probably would have been smarter to schedule to plan your trajectory so you're on the Jupiter's on the other side of the sun by the time you get to its orbit, but who cares? We happen to go close to it because it looks cool and it makes a great idea for the movie. The Jupiter ends up pulling the Earth almost into its atmosphere, and things, you know, the characters in the movie have to try to save Earth because Earth is wandering around the solar system and we have to save it. You chuckled when I said that we decided to move Earth. I mean, come on.
yeah, that wouldn't happen.
Well, let's say, okay, so let me go into my science just for a minute and get it out of the way. The same way I have to get out of the way that the dubbing in this movie is not very good.
No, it's hilarious. That's why I watched it, because I wanted to be reminded of, like, old Ultraman episodes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it is hilarious. Really bad voice acting for all of the people that dub this. What are you doing? Why are you doing that here? You know, why are you trying to do a Chinese accent? I don't understand. But anyway. The science. First of all, in order for this to happen, we have to accept the fact that we will destroy the surface of the Earth. It's because there's no other way to do it. Because the first thing we have to do is we have to stop the rotation of the Earth. That will cause tsunamis, earthquakes, tectonic plate shifts, all of that. So we have to accept the fact that if we put these rockets ringing the equator and they stop the rotation of the Earth, that all of this will happen. The Earth will react to that. Then we have to take one hemisphere, and once we stopped it, we have to take one hemisphere, and basically to them, I think they said 20,000, I took a note, 20,000 engines in order to, or thrusting engines, right. And these aren't, you know, on your model rocket. These are the size of a city engines, in order to propel the huge amount of mass of the Earth out of the gravitational pull of the sun, and then eventually out of the gravitational pull of the solar system and onto another planet, another star. So
you're basically sailing the Earth like a ship.
Correct. Correct. It's a very Arthur C. Clarke sort of story of, you know, similar to Rendezvous with Rama. That was a key that I kind of got out of it. Although Rendezvous with Rama was a spaceship designed to look like a planet or to feel like a planet on the inside sort of thing. This is literally moving a planet, which is, you know, scientifically probably impossible without destroying all life on the planet. But again, that's why they kind of get away with it by saying all life on the planet really exists underground. All the cities are underground. We're underground, and we're using these engines as our cities, essentially. We live underneath the engines that do this. So that's the science that we have to
accept. I mean, just think how long of prep that would take. I mean, we're talking, I guess, generations of people just saying, oh, yeah, we're building towards this.
Yes, of course. I mean, and that's the whole concept that you have to, again, okay, so I'll go to my cultural thing. Read two or three different reviews on this too. One of them was from a Chinese movie reviewer, and it was really interesting because his whole approach was, even with the ludicrous science, as he called it, in this, what he loved about it was it didn't focus on the science. It focused on the people and the characters and the family. And two of the big cultural icons of China and Chinese culture are family and how important family is. And secondly, land. Land has value. As a matter of fact, it's so valuable to the Chinese that they consider it a part of the family. That's why they would never consider abandoning the planet. They would rather risk taking the planet with them because it is part of their culture. They see their heritage and culture in iconography, in buildings, in heritage of actual land and places and temples and those kind of things. So it's a very intrinsic thing to the Chinese culture. And I thought, okay, once I grasp those two concepts, now I even appreciate it even more. Because naturally, they would never abandon the Earth. They would have to stay on it. And it makes sense with all this stuff, like in the doomsday near the end in Jupiter's gravity well, when even the Earth government is doing this big broadcast thing saying, spend some time with your family, go home, stop everything you're doing, because in a few hours, the Earth will be destroyed. You know, and it's like, you know, go home, spend some time with your family. You know, I was going, no, hell no, fight for to the last man kind of thing, you know. But so culturally, that's one of the reasons, one of the things I also appreciated about it when I started diving into it a little bit more.
I read something about the original book.
Mm-hmm.
Written by Lou, what, C-I-X-I-N, however you pronounce that. And that it was, that he used God's perspective, which I'm assuming means omniscient narration.
Yes, yes.
But they said that in order to do that, it would have been such a scientific film, it would not have been entertaining.
Yep.
And that that's why they focus on the characters and the emotions of the story, which makes perfect sense. I mean, it's exactly what Hollywood would do. The realism of – and that's where the cultural difference, I guess, comes in. The family stuff is a little crazy to me, too. Not realistic. But then again, that could be a cultural thing. I read that they decided to take the – Jupiter aspect of the book and make that the primary focus of the film. Mm-hmm. And that really it said that that is really only about five paragraphs in the book. Mm-hmm. And they turned that into this movie, the whole aspect of, you know, Jupiter being the threat. So, I mean, I get it, but I have a feeling that if you were going to read the book because you like this movie, you'd be sorely surprised at how different they are. I don't know.
Of course. I think that it was much more of a science fiction book, so to speak, and science-y. This is much more to give it a dramatic story through line. He is focusing on this one family and their generational issues that they go through, but also their survival instincts sort of thing. You did say it was generational. This movie hints at it a little bit because it does give us a huge time shift after the initial thing. But even prior to the initial thing, the little prologue about these engines being made and everything else is, I mean, that would take decades.
Oh, yeah, it'd be lifetimes.
So your commitment to this project, but they have time. I mean, it's probably 20,000 years currently before our sun will go red dwarf. But when it does, it will engulf almost to Mars. So it will take, you know, all three of the inner planets will be destroyed, including Earth. So what do we do at that time? Do we want to start preparing for it now? Or do we want to just wait till we, you know, burn up into a husk sort of thing? So that was kind of the thing, and focusing on the family, even down to the, you know, the final sacrifice at the end, I got the distinct impression he wasn't sacrificing necessarily to save the Earth. He was sacrificing to save his family.
Right.
That was the thing. It was a very personal, act for him. And I liked that, and I enjoy that about it. And I thought that made sense for me. The final sacrifice wasn't for civilization. It was for his family. You know,
the problem that I have with the movie is that it's just one catastrophic event after the other. There's barely any breathing room in between them.
Correct. And that's one of the things that in my negatives, that's what I have too, because we talk about that a lot, especially in the J.J. Abrams movies or Bruckheimer or any of those, you know, they're always this action feature, then action scene, then action scene, then action scene. And there's no breathing character development in between all of that. Everybody is very one note in this. The son will hate his father until the end. There is no nuance in between there of everything. You know, the girl will constantly get them in trouble until she does a sacrifice or something, you know, heroic near the end. And they stay those kind of one note characters all the way through it. But yeah, there's not a lot of breathing room. It's a lot of action. I mean, scenes wise, one of my things, you know, because we always try to pick what are your favorite scenes or what scenes do you remember? Yeah, you know, my first thing is, whew, there's a lot of action scenes. So what do you pick?
I couldn't pick a scene, really. I mean, I like the stuff when they get near Jupiter because Jupiter looks really cool.
Yeah, one of the reasons they picked it. Yeah,
right. And I kind of like when they get to Shanghai because the city's frozen and all creepy looking. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and having to go into a skyscraper and climb to the very top through the building kind of thing, that was cool. Even though it reminded me
of what's it called we just did.
Cloverfield.
Yeah, Cloverfield, exactly.
That's one of my keys, is that's a Cloverfield note. But I guess for me, I like, first a negative key, I like any of the scenes that don't have Grandpa because I thought he was so over the top. The way he played it and everything else. And that actor, from what I've read, he's a very popular Asian actor. And kind of that's the character he plays. That kind of semi-comic older guy. You know, and there's always one of those. This one movie has essentially two. It has him. It also has the, quote, Australian Chinese guy. And both of those reminded me of that one son in the Korean movie. With the tentacle monster.
Oh, the host, yes.
The host. Mm-hmm.
The one that's kind of a slacker, yeah.
Yeah, both of those are that kind of archetype, you know, character. But for me, any of the scenes on the space station I thought were great. I loved all of them. I love the space station design. I love the Moss design. Moss is their reference to their HAL 9000 computer thing, which I liked. I liked the cyber beds. I mean, the hyper sleep beds, the way they were done. The whole, spacewalk that he and his friend have to attempt to do to get to the command control center. I mean, I could just watch those together.
Yeah.
No snow. Just watch these. So, yeah.
I had another production note that I had forgotten about, but before they let Frank Guo direct this movie, did you know they had contracted other directors? Or they had contacted other directors, asked them to do it?
I read that they had, you know, put the call out for other directors to do
it. One of them was your favorite, James Cameron.
Yeah.
But they also asked Luc Besson and Alfonso Cuarón.
See, Cuarón would have been interesting because he does good films. Mm-hmm. He did Gravity.
So. But they all rejected it, I guess probably because the science is so wonky. I don't know.
Well, or because of the scale, because I also read that it took them almost a year of design work before they shot anything or put anything down,
you
know, just in design.
It's funny that you say that because I don't have many shots from this movie because some of them aren't real. Some of them are like paintings.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Like that one that I just put up to my left is, I'm pretty sure, a painting.
It's one of the engines. Yes, that's correct. Exactly. That's correct. Yeah, they did a lot of pre-production. They did a lot of testing. They did a lot of design work to see if they could even do it. This involved 7 different special effects studios to get it produced. The biggest one, of course, being Weta. Weta is Peter Jackson's workshop that came from New Zealand and Australia. And they primarily did all the spacesuit design, all the weaponry design, a lot of the scenic design elements, in addition, you know, to some of the CGI work. But it took 7 different studios working over a year to do all of the special effects in this movie, all the graphics. Because literally almost every shot is a CGI shot.
I know.
Of some kind.
That's another reason why it's hard for me to consider watching again.
I think it looks good. I think the CGI looks great.
Yeah, but it's all so fast and so unreal that, like I said, it's like being on a roller coaster. You don't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like a thrill ride.
There were a couple of scenes where, one of the keys I have is like comic books in general. Mm-hmm. Like the scene you mentioned in Shanghai when they're climbing up the elevator shaft and the whole frame goes black except for the shaft and you're seeing them climb up. That's mm-hmm. a very, you know, Neil Gaiman-y sort of, you know, comic book frame mm-hmm. showing people yeah. in spacesuits climbing up the little corridor. And that was one. And then later on when he and Han and his sister, even at one point, when they're falling, and it's that kind of, we're watching them fall, and the stuff is going up past them, and the background's moving, and it's that whole, it looks just like a comic book frame. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought, has Marvel influenced us that much? We're just doing that in other movies now?
You know, we talk about, or I talk about foreign films a lot. I'm huge on Korean films. I've always loved Japanese films. And Spanish speaking films. However, I talked about an Indonesian film before we started this, you know, when I was talking about those Satan Slaves movies, and I looked and I had never seen an Indonesian film before. And I was like, really curious. I was like, have I seen a Chinese film before? So I Googled, you know, what are the most popular Chinese films? Uh-huh. And the last Chinese film I saw was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Wow. Yeah.
Is that the right title? I think
yep.
it is.
Yep.
I mean, that's how long ago it's been since China put out a movie that was that popular.
Internationally
and,
popular.
And yes. guess what was before that? Enter the Dragon. Bruce Lee.
That was like 74 or something.
Right, or 71. Yeah, but I love the Bruce Lee movies. So that immediately, I went, okay, yeah, I have seen Chinese movies because I've seen probably all the Bruce Lee movies. And I've seen mm-hmm. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or whatever the name of that is. But anyway, I just found that interesting that, you know, and this movie was such a hit. And it made me wonder, you know, with all these special effects, are they trying to mimic what they think the rest of the world wants to see, America in particular.
Of course. <you know? laughs> Oh, of course.
I guess.
That's why they approached Cameron to begin with.
Maybe.
I mean, yeah. you know, because he's the big computer graphic, you know, advance in technology guru guy.
Right. You know? I mean, Spielberg was too with Jurassic Park, but I don't know.
Yeah, but he tells stories and James Cameron doesn't.
But Spielberg would have focused more on the family too than Cameron probably.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Always.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry for the segue.
No, I like the segue. That was good.
Well, I was going to say, I don't have hardly anything on cast. I mean, I don't have anything on cast at all. I don't know any of these people. And, you know, if they are famous, they're famous in Chinese cinema, which we're unaware of. Yes. As far as awards, this movie won a shit ton of awards, and they're all Asian, almost all Chinese, which yep. is very predictable. So, I mean, they're not festivals that we've heard of. And uh-huh. for some reason, I'm kind of shocked, but it's not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list. And I kind of thought it might be, but it wasn't.
Yeah. I think it should be. I would recommend it for that, but just because it is, to me, it is fantastical. It is huge. It is epic. It is very well done from a story and a structure standpoint. Although the science is very wonky on it, I really love the CGI in it and think it's uber realistic in a lot of places and really good. Tons of keys, which I'm sure we'll get to here in a minute. Mm-hmm. But I had like five or six watch notes I thought were interesting. Because I have, huge exposition dump at the end. Guess we had to have that. Great effects, however, not great dubbing at all.
No,
in fact, there's way too much over-explaining in the dubbing. So much so that, like, you know, somebody will reach out and grab something and you'll hear, you're going to open that? And then he'll open it, you know, and they'll be, run this way. We're running this way. And it's like, you didn't have to, we can see that. You don't have to explain that to us.
I have a theory about that. And I don't know if this interests anybody, but, you know, people that watch foreign films. But almost all of the movies that are foreign or series that are foreign on Netflix are available either dubbed or subtitled.
Uh-huh.
Yet when I get movies like this, they're not. So I'm wondering, does Netflix dub them themselves? Or do they contract a company to do it and have a special company that does it for them?
I'm sure they might. I'm sure as a distribution hub, you would buy the original and then you would say, how am I going to convert this for an international audience?
Right. Oh,
okay. Then I'm going to go into the dubbing studio and we're going to do one in English, one in Spanish, one in, you know, Indonesian.
Yeah, I think Netflix figures, you know, the easiest way to reach an audience is without subtitles. So they offer everything just about dubbed. Usually I don't watch dub versions. This one I wanted to just because I thought it would be kind of funny, but
which it was in places. Yeah. You know, it was way over, like I said, it's way over explained. You know?
Right.
You know, he's pulling the guy through the thing and you're hearing the overdub go, pull faster. And he goes, you need me to pull faster? Yeah, what did I just say? No, but. You know, it was way too much. I did like one of the things I really loved in this, and again, it's a cultural thing, but it's a very sci-fi thing. It's a very, I guess, to some, you know, leftist commie thing or whatever. I love the fact that they have no clue what money is. They are pushed to the extent where there is no money in this civilization because you don't need it. You give goods or services or whatever, and you're indebted to the state because the state, you know, keeps the engine going or whatever, that sort of thing. I thought that was very interesting that when it finally came down to offering money, they didn't have a clue what that was.
No, but there's theft.
Well, yeah, you could, of course, it's, that sound culturally insensitive, but. I'm sure there's IP theft all over this place.
Oh, you know? I see what you're talking about. I'm talking about the kids in the beginning when they steal keys, or what is it they steal to get into that big moving vehicle thing?
Those ID cards.
The ID cards.
To get the ID cards. The ID, exactly. They look like dog tags almost. Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. And there's, you know, there's a black market culture of trade mm-hmm. and stuff. And there is, you know, there's still lying, deceit, you know, all the human foibles are still in here, which is good. One of the things I think this movie lacks, and I've talked about in several movies recently, is there's not a clear cut villain in this piece. There's not a bad guy. There's Jupiter. Not, you know, Jupiter becomes the bad guy, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, which in another way, you know, just thinking out loud now, like we said, we're unscripted, but thinking about through, that's another reason why I prefer this to Avatar, because the villain in Avatar is a cartoon. He's a cartoon colonel and nobody likes him and who cares? I like that better.
Though.
Oh, yeah. The actor's great, mm-hmm. but I'd rather him be the blind Vietnam survivor guy in the house. Breathe. Yeah. Then the knife wielding, get in the big mech warrior guy.
Well, he's going to be a nice guy in the new one, I'm sure.
I've got
like Darth Vader. It'd be total trope.
I'm sure he is. Total trope.
Let's make the bad guy a good guy.
he'll come to the rescue at the end, you know. Some of the action is so frenetic that it's hard to tell what is actually happening. I totally agree.
That's my biggest problem with this movie. And I don't have the patience to go back and rewind and watch everything over again.
That's too much. That's one of my big deal with Transformers. I hate Transformers because it's the same way.
Yep. Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Just because you can create the visual doesn't mean you should.
No.
If it interferes with the storytelling. You know,
well, if you could go to horror storytelling for that matter, I mean, mm-hmm. You want it to be scary, but you have to have moments of rest and moments of recoup. And there are none in this movie.
Correct.
It's just 100 miles an hour straight ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's that overuse of something that has been done before, you know, in these big fights and ramming trucks into each other and all of that. It's like the horror trope of when they figured out they could do the shutter cut edits. So you could have the zombie or the demon at the end of the hallway and suddenly they go, da, 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 and they're right up in front of you and it takes a second sort of thing. I don't, you know, and that became such a trope for a while.
You know, a good movie to compare this to would be Fury Road, Mad Max Fury Road. That movie has incredible, except it's practical. It's not really CGI at all.
It's all practical, yeah.
But, I mean, it has incredible amounts of action in it, but it knows when to let you breathe.
Yes. Good, good, good. That's a great key. That is a great comparison.
Well, I don't know
comparison.
That it's a key. It's just a comparison, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But in how to tell a story as opposed to, you know, just keep the action people. Overwhelming it. Yep.
Yes.
But I've got, I really loved the last reveal, meaning the last plan of igniting Jupiter. I thought that was a surprise kind of twist. It was really cool.
And it seems believable. You know?
And yeah. That one is believable. Yeah. Yeah. Although, again, what you would do structurally to the Earth, blowing it away from...
I think it
from,
would just be a cinder.
Would, yeah. Well, it wouldn't be heat so much as it would be, you know, things would collapse and crumble and, you know, and all that. So, yes, there's that. And then one of my last ones is I've got everybody does better with intense reprogramming on a computer once they have a cigarette. Because remember, he trades him. He sits down and it's all this tension, but he's going to take the time to light the cigarette and enjoy it before he starts programming, you know. And I went, yep, that's a hacker for you, sort of thing. I did like, and it's very similar. The key I have to it is Guillermo del Toro, what we just watched with Devil's Backbone, is this starts with the voiceover saying, "My son, I'm sorry."
And he's a dead narrator.
And it ends with the voiceover of "My son, I'm sorry, I couldn't be there." Da, 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 you know, right. I thought that was very. It was a really cool key.
Yeah, I mean, technically, you could say the Devil's Backbone is a key, but anything is a key that really has that narrator.
The dead narrator, or the narrator, the unreliable narrator. But this one's actually a deceased narrator, kind of like Sunset Boulevard, like we said in the. In the Devil's Backbone.
Episode. You know what? I would use Sunset Boulevard because to me, that's the one that originated that trope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely.
And I said that when we did Devil's Backbone. Yeah. Uh-huh. You mentioned, and this is some trivia that I have, that you were not a fan of the grandfather, but he's a popular comic actor in China. Did you read about his involvement in this movie and how it grew?
No, please tell.
Okay, I'm going to read this verbatim because it's just easier than me stumbling. But originally, Wu Jing, one of the protagonists, the guy that played the grandfather, only agreed to be in one scene. Since he was the only big star of the film, the director changed the script and kept putting him in more scenes. One day of shooting became weeks, then months. Wu Jing's pay for each movie is around $10 million. I didn't know people in China made that much money. But anyway, after weeks of shooting, the director asked him that since the movie was over budget, maybe he didn't mind not getting paid.
Details.
Wu Jing loved the director and the film so much that not only did he agree not to be paid, he invested his own money into the movie, about $9 million. Many people thought Wu Jing was conned by the director at that time, but in fact, without Wu's name, the movie would not have sold to so many theaters at all. If director Frant is the father of the film, then Wu Jing, it is its guardian angel.
Wow, and that's a great story.
Yeah, and it said this kind of thing rarely happens in the Chinese industry.
Wow.
So I thought that was fascinating.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
That is, and I didn't know that at all. I knew that he was the name. He was the draw sort of thing for it.
So you might want to reevaluate your opinion.
But
Grandpa.
Also, wasn't the – what'd you say? I'm sorry?
I said you might want to reevaluate your opinion of Grandpa.
Well,
he's the reason this movie exists.
And wasn't the lead? The lead is like some big action hero in China.
The father?
The father,
yeah,
yes.
He's got a good look. He looks like a leading man. So I don't know. But, I mean, it makes sense.
Well, one of my keys is Inception because he's Matthew McConaughey. You know, he's the astronaut missing his family out there who does a sacrifice to save everybody.
Interstellar, you mean?
Yeah, Interstellar. Sorry. Yeah.
I had that one, too. I had forgotten to write it down, but I remembered thinking about it while we were doing it. And then I only had one other trivia thing. You know, it's not important. I'm not going to read it. It's too long.
Something I have one trivia that I researched, which is this scientist actually put the science behind all of this. And he was saying, well, the initial principle is, you know, based on the sun, the mass of the earth, we know, and the gravitational pull, we know those constants. So we can work out the formula for how much kinetic energy you need to pull the earth away from the sun's orbit. And we basically would require, and I wrote this down, 42 kilometers per second of kinetic energy, which is tremendous. You know, 42 kilometers a second of thrust. And, but he said, when you think about it though, and he goes, I'm not trying to give in to the science of this movie because the science is wonky. He said, but if you think about it, our current speed, you may not feel like you're traveling right now, but you're actually traveling at 30 kilometers per second right now in orbit. We would just need to change that orbit to one single thrust to pull out away from the sun, you know. So anyway, so the science is in there, but highly improbable.
Yeah.
And you have to take the caveats of all life on the face of the planet would be destroyed. You would have to live underground.
You would have to. I mean, that's what, when we were talking about taking generations of preparation, I mean, just having underground cities would take hundreds of years.
To build and create and everything. Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, so you basically, the timeline of this movie moves as fast as the action. In a way, when you think about it, conceptually. Mm-hmm. I was hunting for material on this movie. I've got to where we did less popular movies this season. Mm-hmm. And I find myself sometimes having to go to other sites and hunt stuff other than IMDb because I'm not getting enough information on these films. So I was looking for reviews of this film, and my favorite is one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It's this guy said, "The Wandering Earth isn't a bad film at all if you want to kill a few hours wondering what's going to explode next."
Not bad.
Kind of agree with that.
Although it's not so much, I would not call Bruckheimer movies, I always call explosion movies, you know, all the Transformers and all that. To me, these aren't so much explosions as they are some form of people in peril stories. It's either a chasm or you're falling down a well or an elevator, or you're trying to get across from one end area of the space station to the other through a space, you know, it's not necessarily explosions so much as it is, you know, life threatening situations that just one after the other after the other.
Yeah. It's like, are they superheroes? Because they survive every single one of them.
Right.
Except the grandfather. Right. But yeah.
But yeah, he kind of had to do that.
Oh, and the Russian astronaut, he dies too.
Yeah, man, he should not have. I liked him; he was a cool character. Mm-hmm. But that was a very, you know. Anyway, okay, we're getting into keys, so we can do that.
Keys.
It's keys time. Which are key influences and those kind of things. Of course, I have two to start with that are ancient keys for this, so to speak. One is in doing research, I found out that the actual novel. Mm-hmm. Was based on an old Chinese fable about a man who wanted to move two mountains off of his land. And so he began moving them a bucket at a time. And he got his family to help him move them a bucket at a time. And all the townsfolk would come and go, "Why are you doing this? You know, you'll never be able to move these mountains in your lifetime." And he says, "No, but generations from now, these mountains will be gone." Yeah. And that was the fable of it would take generations, but exactly. It would eventually do it.
Yeah. We've said it countless times. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And of course, the other one is Noah's Ark. This is Noah's Ark. We have to preserve, we have to take, you know, everybody, put them on this vessel and survive the apocalypse sort of thing.
Well, and the Noah's Ark parable is very prominent in a lot of sci-fi.
Oh, yes.
Too.
How do we save the race? How do we save humanity? Sometimes it's putting ourselves in, you know, android bodies, or sometimes it's, you know, getting on a spaceship that's a colony ship that takes us away from Earth, or whatever.
Embryos to other planets or whatever.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all this save the species, and that's a huge, you know, sci-fi trope anyway.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
My first key was going to be the book, which you've already mentioned. It is a movie based on a novel, but I'll just go ahead and say it. The sequel is playing in my theater right now.
Yeah, the sequel just came out.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. I looked I was Googling The Wandering Earth, and it said showtimes. And I went, what? Is this movie in theaters? And it was The Wandering Earth 2. So, yep. Yeah, there's all, I mean, I'm guessing this is the journey. And then maybe The Wandering Earth 3 will be the arrival of Alpha Centauri or something. Who knows?
Well, I watched the trailer.
Uh-oh.
And the father is in the trailer.
It's his ghost.
It must be, I'm hoping. Or they're going to come up with something about how he got to an escape pod just in time or something. Oh, my God. You know what I mean? Yeah, there's that. But it also, the trailer prequelizes this too. It talks about the space elevator disaster when they were first building the engines. It talks about the first engine disaster that happened. And that all predates this movie. So evidently they're going to do some of that generational storytelling in the past mm-hmm. as part of the sequel, which might be cool. It might be. It's the same exact same production company, same director, writers, everything. So
I will watch it once.
Yeah. Once. You'll see it once. But yeah, that's a good key is there's already a sequel.
Yeah. It may so, be yeah. on the list next season.
Yeah. I have a few. I have, of course, every disaster movie ever done, because that's what this is. This is a disaster movie. No way to say.
Any in particular? Maybe Earthquake?
Specifically, Earthquake at the Earth's Core, Day After Tomorrow, which is about the climate change and everybody freezes when they go outside. So it's got a lot of to do with that. Armageddon, of course, except Armageddon is them on, you know, going to the asteroid, trying to prevent it from hitting Earth. This is trying to keep Earth from hitting Jupiter.
It's the same sort of thing. It's same, saving the Earth from disaster. Yeah. Yes. Armageddon and it's a is bunch actually of, my biggest. That's the one that stuck out mm-hmm. in my head the most watching this movie was Armageddon.
Yeah. And it's basically a bunch of truckers and a SEAL team who are trying to do it.
Right.
You know, kind of thing. So, yeah.
Well, I have 2001 for obvious reasons. Of course. Because of Moss, the artificial intelligence that turns against the protagonist at the end and makes the survival of the race a priority. So it's okay to extinguish those living now as long as they get those embryos in that wherever, some habitable planet.
Yep.
So essentially the artificial intelligence becomes the enemy. And then Gravity, that whole spacewalk thing you were talking about where they were outside. I was like, this is just like Gravity.
It's just like Gravity.
Yeah.
And there's also, you know, 2010 in there because it's the Russian and is his best friend.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And we did that earlier this season.
And I also have, and I don't know if you'll get it because I don't know if you've seen the original, but Moon. The movie Moon, the design of the robot in that, and Wall-E, the design of the robot in Wall-E are very similar to the design of Moss. But especially Moon, the very square looking with one red light and it can rotate on a gimbal axis, but it's basically a big funky box sort of thing is the computer. That's in Moon, exactly. Except in Moon, the voice is Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. I liked all the tech in the space station, especially when he's being ordered to go into hypersleep, and yet he doesn't. He's still talking to the thing and saying, do this, do that.
Yeah.
And all the shit that he's saying is happening on Earth right after he says it.
I was like, and it's got a heads-up really display. Tech. It's got a heads-up display. Yeah, and all that. Yeah, that was really good. And I have that as far as design. There's certain design keys in this. There's Total Recall. There's Aliens. You know, the trucks that they're driving are very similar to the armed carrier in Alien.
They look
even
very
down to when it's and the way it's, you know, such huge wheels and then the way it's bouncing against walls and other trucks and things. That's a very Aliens sort of thing. Two other disaster movies, The Core, which is the one where they try to get in the vessel and go and reignite the Earth's core because that's what's causing climate change. And When Worlds Collide, the old George Powell movie. I mean, it is directly an influence on this, except they are leaving Earth. But again, it's an arc story. We've got these head scientists and the best breeders, and we're putting them on this ship, and we're sending it to the nearest planet.
I haven't seen that movie, but
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a good movie.
I know it's on our list. I just have never seen it, and I had a feeling it was going to – I mean, the title alone suggests that that's what the movie's going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I only have one other, and I got this one from IMDb, and it's a music cue. It says, despite some similarities to Interstellar and The Dark Knight Rises, the score was not composed by Hans Zimmer. It's scored by a guy named Rock Chen,
uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Who composed the music. And I guess maybe he used Hans Zimmer as an influence, is what it sounds like to me.
Obviously. I mean, yeah, he did Interstellar, of course, which everybody loves. I loathe, but, you know, everybody likes that. So, yeah, Hans Zimmer, I'm sure, had an influence on the composer, probably.
Right. So, I would say Hans Zimmer, I guess, would be the key if the music is very similar. I've only seen Interstellar once, and it's been a long time since I saw The Dark Knight Rises. But I do remember the music a little bit. So, it's action music, basically.
Yeah, Zimmer does a lot of synth action, mm-hmm. is what he does. Yeah. And then I just have a couple more, but they're mostly in the design element, of course. This whole, when they're in the city and at the beginning and trying to escape and all that, it has a lot of that, you know, Blade Runner, Ghost in the Shell, Fifth Element, you know, those kind of scientific designs of the city, very crowded, working through it, everybody doing their own thing. There's lots and lots of stuff in every frame, whether it's neon signage or people moving around or robots or whatever. You know, so there's a lot of that in it. And I have Terminator 2 because Grant Wu, who directed this, has said in like three different interviews, Terminator 2 was the inspiration for him to even direct movies in the first place.
Yeah, I read that too.
So that was a big, you know, inspiration there.
I just thought of another one while you were talking, and it's mm-hmm. AI. The frozen stuff at the end of AI when the world has moved on and it's kind of frozen over. That's what this world looks like now.
Yeah, that generational story mm-hmm. element. Yep, yep. I could see that. I think that's all I've got.
Yeah,
I mean, again, it's so many disaster movies influenced it. So many other sci-fi kind of tropes influenced it. But I still think it comes off as a great ride, to your point. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend people watch it. And it's, for me, I'd watch it before Avatar. But, you know, I know how people are. So.
Yeah, I've seen Avatar twice, but only because I couldn't remember it. Yeah, I would probably never watch it again. But then again, like I said, I probably would never watch this again. I would watch the sequel just to see where they go with it.
Mm-hmm.
But so in summation, I mean, I would recommend it just from a cultural aspect, if anything. You know, I would say if you've never seen a Chinese action movie, you need to see this movie because
Definitely.
It is a lot more action-packed than Enter the Dragon.
Oh, yeah.
A lot less kung fu, too.
A lot less kung fu. As a matter of fact, there's none in this at all.
At all.
This has a lot more action, a lot more Americanization, I guess, or Western influence.
Or Western
a lot,
influence is a better
word. You know,
part, yeah.
with the guns and with the SEAL team and all of
and
that.
And the big moving vehicles crashing into everything.
Into everything. Yes.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for The Wandering Earth. As I said, the sequel is out of theaters now. If you want to catch both, one's on Netflix and one's in theaters. David and I would like to thank you for joining us today here on Johnny Has the Keys. If you're new to us, please subscribe. If you're watching us on YouTube or thumbs up us, if you're listening to us on out there in podcast land, please give us a review or, you know, a thumbs
Please.
Up or whatever it is that you can do on your platform of choice. Anything that helps us get the word out that we are or that you are a sci-fi and horror nerd like we are. And if you don't, I mean, if there's more that you want from us, believe it or not, we have some bonus shows on Patreon for as little as a cup of coffee a month. You can access bonus shows for a little bit more. We have two other series. One is on the original Star Trek. It is called The Dilithium Chamber.
Yes.
And another is X-Files Declassified, where we go over individually these episodes from these classic series. And until next week, David, I'll be seeing you out there.
See you then.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.